I mean, you could be like the most highly trained, incredibly empathetic therapist in British Columbia,
Yeah,
right?
right.
And still be completely out of business in 6 months.
Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt.
It is a harsh reality, but it happens, you know, every single day. Today, we're really looking at why an empty bank account is actually the number one cause of poor clinical outcomes for new private practices.
Right.
So, welcome to the deep dive. Our mission today is super straightforward. We are giving you the beginner therapist looking to launch a solo private practice right here in BC, a clear, actionable roadmap to survival.
And success, really.
Yeah, exactly. Survival and success. Because we've sifted through like a mountain of interviews, consultant strategies, and these really raw, unfiltered stories from Canadian therapists who have navigated this exact
The
transition.
ones who made it and the ones who learned the hard way.
Exactly. So the goal is to help you sidestep the burnout, the financial panic, and, you know, the isolation that derails so many new practitioners.
So, okay, let's unpack this. Because taking that leap from clinician to business owner is this massive paradigm shift that grad school just rarely prepares you for.
It really is a completely different skill set, and you hit the nail on the head regarding grad school. I mean, most programs train you meticulously on clinical modalities, ethics, therapeutic alliance.
Yeah, all the clinical stuff.
Right. But they leave you completely in the dark about cash flow, marketing, operational boundaries, all of that.
It's wild.
It is. And it's entirely valid to have high ambitions for your practice. You know, you want to help people. But we have to ground this conversation in reality from the very first step.
Right.
The recurring truth we see in the data and the personal accounts is that clinical excellence just doesn't automatically generate a sustainable business. If your business foundation is fundamentally cracked, you simply will not be able to keep your doors open long enough to help the community you're so eager to serve. I want to start exactly there, actually, at the foundation. Let's look at the launch pad. We're talking about the absolute starting line today.
Ground zero.
Yeah, what you can and honestly should do before you even see your first private client. Or even better, what you can tackle while you're still finishing up your exams.
Right, because there's a lot of waiting involved.
So much waiting. So there are three very specific pre-graduation steps that keep coming up: picking a business name, building a website, and starting a blog. And on that very first step, picking a name, there is a massive trap waiting for you.
Oh, the personal name trap.
Yes, the advice is unanimous across our sources. Do not use your personal name for the business.
Well, you know, what's fascinating here is the underlying psychology of why so many beginners make that exact mistake.
Like why we all want to do it.
Yeah. When you're just starting out, you're battling imposter syndrome. Hanging a virtual shingle with your own name on it, it feels like this validating milestone, like, I made it.
Right, I'm a real therapist now.
Exactly. Plus, it's often cheaper and logistically easier to just register as a sole proprietor under your legal name. But you have to project 5, maybe 10 years into the future.
Right.
If your business is literally called Jane Smith Counseling, you are hard coding your personal identity into the business architecture.
That makes total sense. It's exactly like hard coding your administrative password into a piece of software, right?
Yeah.
If the entire system is hard coded specifically to you, you can never hand off the admin rights later. Like you are trapped in that exact configuration.
Precisely. Let's say you become incredibly successful. Your caseload is completely full. You have a 6-month wait list, and you decide to hire an associate therapist to take the overflow.
Which is a great problem to have.
It is. But clients are going to resist seeing that associate. Why? Because they specifically called Jane Smith Counseling to see Jane Smith. They feel like they're getting a bait and switch.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I didn't even think about that from the client's perspective.
Yeah. Furthermore, if you ever decide to retire or transition out of the field, you've essentially built a business that has zero resale value.
Because you can't sell yourself.
Exactly. There are very few buyers for a practice that is fundamentally branded around a specific person who is actively walking out the door. By choosing a broader conceptual name early on, you give your business the oxygen it needs to scale beyond just you.
Okay, that makes total sense. So you pick a broader name, you secure the URL, you set up a clean website, and you start writing some blog posts. But then, almost inevitably, you hit the wall, the waiting game.
Ah, yes, the administrative limbo.
Yeah, if you're applying to the BCACC to become an RCC, or you're prepping for the jurisprudence exam for the BC College of Psychologists, you're going to be sitting in a waiting room. The wait times for licenses and liability insurance can just be agonizingly long.
And that limbo period can be psychologically taxing. You're ready to go, but legally, your hands are tied. This is exactly why tackling those early administrative steps like blogging and website building is so crucial.
Because it gives you something to do.
It provides a locus of control. You are actively building the infrastructure of your business while you wait. Take blogging, for example.
Right.
Search engine optimization, or SEO, is a slow mechanism. It takes Google months to crawl your site, index your content, and rank you as a credible local authority.
So you plant the seeds early.
Exactly. If you start writing those articles while you're waiting for your license, by the time your doors actually open, those posts have had time to simmer in the search algorithms and actually start driving traffic.
But there is a huge caution flag here regarding what not to do while you wait.
Oh, absolutely.
Do not jump the gun on your infrastructure. Like, wait to pay for your EMR, your electronic medical record system, until your license is actually in your hand.
Right. Do not spend that money yet.
You don't want to be bleeding monthly subscription fees for a system you cannot legally use to see clients yet.
Exactly. Preserve your capital. However, when you are legally ready to pull the trigger on an EMR, the consensus strongly points toward one specific platform for Canadian therapists.
The JNAB.
The JNAB, yes.
And the mechanism behind why it's so highly recommended is super relevant for you listening here in BC. It's not just about having like a pretty interface or whatever. It's a Canadian company.
Which is viable.
Yeah, which means all of your sensitive client data is stored securely on Canadian servers.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it is fundamentally a legal and compliance issue. Under BC's privacy laws, specifically PIPA, handling personal health information requires strict safeguards.
Right.
If you use a cheaper US-based EMR, that client data is crossing borders and is potentially subject to foreign data laws.
Like the Patriot Act.
Exactly, like the Patriot Act. That creates a massive compliance headache for you as a practitioner. A localized EMR bypasses that entire vulnerability. It checks all the boxes for provincial privacy regulations while giving you the scheduling and billing tools you need.
Okay, so the foundation is laid, the compliance is locked in, and you finally get that email saying your license is approved.
The best feeling.
It is. But suddenly, the training wheels come off. And that brings us to a very harsh reality check. The immediate financial pressure of keeping the lights on in a notoriously expensive province like British Columbia.
Right, because BC is not cheap.
Not at all. The transition from student or even agency worker to solo practitioner is incredibly fragile financially. The biggest mistake we see beginners make is expecting full-time income from their private practice immediately.
It just doesn't happen that way.
No. Private practice is not a retail store where you unlock the door and foot traffic just wanders in. It's a slow burn. It takes time to build a clinical reputation.
Right. And so the most robust piece of advice you can take to heart here is to keep a bridge job.
A bridge job, meaning you keep working part-time at a community agency or maybe a university health center or a hospital while you build the private practice on your evenings or weekends.
Exactly. It subsidizes the growth of your practice. Or if you are leaping in full-time, you must have 3 to 6 months of actual living expenses saved up.
Yeah, and there is a deeply cautionary tale in our sources about a therapist named Veronica.
Oh, Veronica's story is rough.
It's so rough. She decided to launch her practice in Halifax, completely rushed the financial transition without a bridge job, and literally spent her first week sleeping on a yoga mat in her empty office.
Because she couldn't afford rent for both an apartment and her practice space.
Exactly. She was scrambling just to survive.
And when you're in survival mode, your brain makes terrible long-term decisions. Which leads us to the next massive pitfall, the $50 an hour trap.
Oh, I see this all the time.
Because beginners are so desperate to fill their caseload and, you know, get away from that yoga mat, they set their rates incredibly low, sometimes 25 or 50 bucks a session.
They think, I just need bodies in the door. I just need some cash flow.
It is the ultimate manifestation of the scarcity mindset. When fear is driving the business, the math goes out the window.
But wait, I have to push back here for a second.
Okay, go for it.
Isn't the whole point of entering the mental health field to be accessible, to help people who are genuinely struggling?
Yes, absolutely.
How do you look at a beginner therapist who is probably already battling a mountain of imposter syndrome and tell them they need to charge premium market rate fees right out of the gate? It feels, I don't know, contradictory to the mission of therapy.
That is a highly common and completely natural internal conflict. It feels inherently guilty to place a high monetary value on empathy and care.
Exactly.
But let's look at the underlying mechanics of that $50 session. Out of that $50, you have to deduct the proportionate cost of your office space, your EMR subscription, your marketing.
Mandatory continuing education.
Yes, and your professional liability insurance.
Right, the overhead doesn't shrink just because your fee did.
Exactly. Then, from what is left, you have to take a massive chunk off the top for taxes. When you're self-employed, you're responsible for both the employee and employer portions of the Canada Pension Plan, plus your income tax.
Oh, man. Yeah, you're easily losing another 25 to 30% right there.
Easily. When all the dust settles, you are literally left with pennies per hour.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens when you're left with pennies? You realize you have to see 35 or 40 clients a week just to pay for your groceries and your rent in Surrey.
Which is a fast track to clinical negligence, honestly.
Exactly. You become exhausted, resentful, and completely burned out. Mm-hmm. There is a direct, undeniable causal relationship between a therapist's business health and their clinical outcomes.
That makes a lot of sense.
If you're sitting in a session silently stressing about how you're going to make your rent, your nervous system is dysregulated. That anxiety inevitably seeps into the therapy room. The client feels it.
They totally do.
A healthy business that actually generates a sustainable profit is the only vehicle that allows you to show up fully present for your community over a 30-year career rather than burning out in 3 years.
Wow. Okay, that really shifts the perspective. You cannot pour from an empty cup, and you certainly cannot heal from an empty bank account.
Well said.
And speaking of making rent, we have to talk about the elephant in the room. BC real estate.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Renting a beautiful, dedicated office space in places like North Vancouver or Kelowna or Victoria that will drain your operating budget instantly. But the consensus is clear. You do not need to take on massive debt for a gorgeous office right out of the gate.
The urge to curate the perfect Instagram-worthy office is strong, but it's a trap. You can launch a fully functional practice for under $1,500.
How?
By leveraging the sharing economy. You sublet an office by the hour, or you rent a half-day block from an established practice that isn't using their room on a Tuesday morning.
Yeah.
Or you just start entirely with telehealth.
Because at the end of the day, your clients are not coming to you for your expensive mid-century modern couch.
No, they aren't.
The therapeutic relationship is the intervention. The connection is what heals, not the ambient lighting.
Exactly. And by keeping your overhead radically low at the beginning, you give yourself the greatest gift a new business owner can have.
Yeah.
The freedom to say no.
Oh, that's huge.
You are not forced to take on every single client who calls just to feed the overhead beast. You can grow at a natural, clinically safe pace.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Let's say you figure out the money, you have low overhead, you set a fair rate, but then you run into the daily operational grind, the myth of doing it all.
Right.
When you start a solo practice, it's like operating a submarine. You are the engine, right? You are the therapist powering the whole thing, but suddenly you're also manning the periscope as the marketer, you're running the radio as the receptionist, and you're trying to fix the plumbing as the IT department.
That is a perfect way to conceptualize it.
If the engine spends all day running around flipping dials, the vessel inevitably stalls.
The cognitive load of constantly switching between clinical presence and administrative triage is just staggering.
Yeah.
Just because you can build your own website, answer every intake call, and reconcile every billing error doesn't mean you should.
Right.
Delegating the administrative tasks you are weak at is not a luxury. It is a vital mechanism for survival.
But the sources point out an even more dangerous boundary mistake than administrative overload, and that is clinical overload, operating out of fear and taking absolutely any client who walks through the door.
Oh, the generalist trap.
Yeah, there's a story that stood out about a therapist named Maya. She opened her practice, and because she was terrified of the phone not ringing, she signed up for every single insurance panel she could find.
A classic mistake.
She accepted individual adults, she took on children, she agreed to see high conflict couples, she took whole families.
And the result was entirely predictable.
Yeah.
Within a year, she was seeing nearly 40 people a week across a massive spectrum of clinical presentations.
Yeah.
She had perfectly, flawlessly replicated the exact toxic, exhausting, high-volume clinic environment she had just left to escape.
Yeah.
She became her own worst boss.
So how do you avoid becoming Maya? The advice is unanimous. You must niche down. But why does niching down actually work? It feels counterintuitive.
It does feel that way.
Like, if you shrink your audience, shouldn't you get fewer clients?
It feels counterintuitive. But let's look at the psychology of the consumer and the cognitive load of the therapist. If you are a generalist, your website copy is inherently bland. It says, I help people with anxiety, depression, and life transitions.
Sounds like everyone else.
Exactly. No one wakes up in a cold sweat at 2 a.m. and Googles life transitions. They Google OCD specialist for teen boys or EMDR for birth trauma.
That is so true.
When you have a highly specific niche, you attract highly motivated clients who are looking for you specifically. Your marketing becomes 10 times easier because you know exactly whose pain points you're speaking to.
And it protects your brain too. If you treat a gifted teen with ADHD at 9 a.m., a couple dealing with infidelity at 10 a.m., and an elder with grief at 11 a.m., your brain is violently context switching all morning.
Exactly. Niching drastically reduces your clinical prep time and your emotional whiplash. It preserves your energy. Because burnout in this field is insidious. We have this dramatic image of burnout as lying on the floor weeping from exhaustion.
Right, like total collapse.
But often, it's much quieter. Sometimes burnout is simply sitting in your car on a Monday morning, staring at the steering wheel, and quietly dreading your first client of the week. It's a slow, quiet leak of your passion.
So how do you stop the leak? There's a strategy mentioned called the plus one, minus one rule for weekend recovery.
Yes. It is a mechanism to actively protect your clinical energy rather than just passively hoping you recover.
Okay, tell me how it works.
The rule is simple. You look at your upcoming weekend and you intentionally add one rejuvenating activity, something that genuinely restores your nervous system, and you actively remove one draining task.
Okay, I have to jump in here. Looking at this and thinking, if I am completely drowning in clinical notes and admin work by Friday afternoon, isn't telling me to actively plan my weekend just adding another chore to my list? It sounds exhausting.
It's a fair point.
Yeah.
But there is a crucial difference between passive collapse and active recovery. If you just collapse onto the couch all weekend scrolling your phone, your brain remains in a low-level state of stress.
Okay, yeah.
You haven't actually recovered. You've just paused. The plus one, minus one rule is about intentionality. Maybe your plus one is a 30-minute walk in the BC forest with your phone physically turned off and left in the car. It is a deliberate reset.
And the minus one.
The minus one is critical. Maybe you remove the obligation of checking your work email until Monday at 8 a.m. You are building a hard boundary to protect your capacity.
I like that. But even if you build the perfect boundary with your niche and you protect your physical schedule with active recovery, there is a silent energy drain that no scheduling app can fix. And that is the sudden, deafening isolation of leaving a clinic.
This raises an important question. Who is actually in your corner? Moving from an agency to a solo practice means you lose the built-in ecosystem.
You really do.
You no longer have a break room to vent in after a difficult session. You don't have colleagues down the hall to casually consult with when a case gets ethically murky or emotionally heavy.
Think about it right now as you're listening. Who is in your corner? If you hit a clinical wall tomorrow with a high-risk client, who are the three people you would call? If you cannot name them instantly, you need to build that network today.
Immediately.
Yeah. Sitting alone in your office dealing with secondhand trauma day after day isn't just sad, it is professionally dangerous.
Isolation breeds anxiety. When you're alone, every clinical mistake feels catastrophic, and every administrative hurdle feels insurmountable.
There is a fantastic story that illustrates how to solve this. It's about Ursula Kerr, who moved to Campbell River, BC, to launch her practice. Now, Campbell River is a smaller community.
Right, Vancouver Island.
Yeah, the dynamics are very different there than in downtown Vancouver. But before she even fully launched, before she had her website perfect or her business name legally registered, she just started reaching out to other local clinical social workers and therapists.
And the response she got destroys the myth that private practice is a zero-sum game. Those established therapists didn't view her as a threat to their market share.
Not at all.
They viewed her as a much-needed colleague. They sat down with her and essentially handed her the playbook for success in that specific town. They told her exactly which local doctors were the best referral sources, how the major local employers' insurance plans actually paid out, and which EMRs functioned best for their specific needs.
And that dynamic goes far beyond just getting good administrative advice. The referral ecosystem in private practice is completely driven by trusted relationships. The absolute best, highest converting referrals you will ever get do not come from a Google ad.
Never.
They come from other therapists whose waitlists are full or who recognize that a client fits your specific niche perfectly.
Healing happens in community. We preach that to our clients constantly, but we somehow develop amnesia when it applies to ourselves. Connection brings professional resilience.
It really does.
You need a community of peers who understand the unique, invisible weight of this work. People who can validate your clinical struggles and who can genuinely celebrate your entrepreneurial wins. Building a network of like-minded peers is not just a nice thing to do for your mental health. Mm. It is literally the ultimate, most sustainable marketing strategy you can deploy.
So what does this all mean for you, the beginner therapist in British Columbia, ready to take the leap? It really comes down to protecting yourself at every single stage of the journey.
Yes.
It means protecting your future by choosing a broad business name and securing your digital footprint early. It means protecting your nervous system financially by keeping a bridge job, ignoring the urge to buy expensive decor, and setting your fees based on the cold hard math of self-employment, not your imposter syndrome.
Here, here.
And it means protecting your clinical energy by locking in a specific, highly targeted niche and surrounding yourself with a real community of peers so you never have to carry the weight of this work alone. Building a solo practice is ultimately about designing a life, not just building yourself a new job with a worse boss.
And as you think about the architecture of the life you're designing, I want to leave you with a profound reflection drawn from our material. It references Bryony Ware's seminal book, The Top 5 Regrets of the Dying.
Powerful book.
It is. Ware was a palliative care nurse, and she spent years recording the most common, painful regrets of her patients in their final weeks of life. The top two regrets, almost universally, were, I wish I hadn't worked so hard, and I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me.
Well,
as you lay the concrete foundation for your new practice in British Columbia, you have a very real choice in front of you. Are you deliberately building a private practice that will serve your life, fuel your joy, and protect your well-being? Or, in the frantic rush to succeed and prove yourself, are you simply building a machine that will work you to the bone? Think carefully about the house you're building on that foundation.